Hello, it's just gone 4 o'clock. This is Evening Extra. We've talked a lot about long COVID on this programme over the last year. Tonight we've news of what's been described as a significant breakthrough in treatment for the condition. It all centres on blood clots, a common side effect of COVID, it seems. These are microclots that have been targeted by this treatment. We'll tell you all about it. The Health Minister, Robin Swan, says we're facing the most difficult winter ever experienced because of COVID pressures. And the Justice Minister, Naomi Long, says she's concerned that lifting restrictions on nightclubs will lead to more cases. We're going to get into all of that. Plus, we'll hear from the journalist Melanie Reid, who became a tetraplegic 11 years ago after a riding accident. Her book is one of the recommendations for Book Week NI, and she'll tell us about how her life-changing injuries affected her outlook on life. We're looking forward to that. It's part of BBC Northern Ireland's Book Week celebrations. Well, look who it is.
I blame you for not telling me what time it was.
What time do you call this tower, Mills?
It's 4 o'clock.
You know
this
what
is
it
evening
was?
Extra.
You know what it was?
It's the clocks.
The clocks in the newsroom are still slow. Good of you to join us, Tara, and good of you, the listeners, to join us as well this Friday. While Tara logs in and catches her breath, let's get the BBC News at 4 o'clock with David Hedges.
Thanks.
I felt helpless because the law couldn't protect me. The criminal law couldn't protect me. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to fight back. And that sense of that of empowerment that I had when I then did fight back. Now, the scary thing, I think, here's my view. So I had a brilliant employer standing right beside me at the BBC. And I had an international lawyer in Paul Tweed who does this every day.
But you also have...
the people that don't.
But you also have personal resources that allow you to kind of throw money at this problem, to be blunt. So you started... You mounted your own investigation, essentially.
I did, yeah.
So...
And I sent one of my guys to his door, to wrap his door, to hand him... a file that was as thick as an Amazon package with the abuse that he had levelled to me every day.
How did they find him?
Because I'm trying to track down and I am going to pursue a number of others, I'm not going to, you know, reveal my tactics.
Well, who is he? And I know you're not going to name him because you've agreed to name him. I'll ask you why, but can you give us a sense of who this individual... I mean, we know it's a guy, but is he a professional? Is he middle-aged? Is he a young person?
Sure. So, you know, the irony here is this guy wants me to be honourable and keep my word, which I will do when he acted completely differently, but I will. So I will not reveal his identity, but I can tell you that he is a professional person with a very respectable job that sits in the middle of this community with lots of people around him, and, you know, proper house, proper job, family around them. And, you know, the mind boggles as to why he felt in his life he needed to be so vicious against me.
Do you know, have you ever met this individual?
Not that I know. No. No.
Do you want to?
Sorry?
Do you want to?
Oh, I would love to. Oh, I would love to. Would I love to? I was tempted to hand the legal stuff to myself, to wrap the door. I was very tempted. I would love to look at a guy like that and say, how did you become so twisted and so warped that, you know, lots of people have perception of us because of the job we do, and they probably have perception of me because of the Nolan show. I'm trying to hold down a job, and that's all I'm trying to do. And I'd love to front up to him. I'd love to.
Now, you've agreed not to name him. Just in a sentence, why?
That was a very, very fine judgment call. He was so vicious and arrogant in his false Twitter world. But as soon as he knew that I knew who he was, he completely crumbled. So he started saying that he had personal security worries. He has a wife, he has a family around him, and I don't want to wreck somebody.
Okay.
I don't want to do that.
You've described him as a professional with a good job. Is he the kind of guy who will find a six-figure sum for damages easily, or do you care?
You know, The important thing for me, I don't know. The important thing for me is to send out a very, very strong message that if you are intent on sitting as some type of, you know, if you get off on abusing people, you will be tracked down and you will have a high price to pay. And, you know, Declan, I think that there, you know, there are journalists, as you know, here in BBC Northern Ireland who are suffering abuse, and all they're doing is doing their job. There are newspaper journalists, like brilliant journalists, like Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph, Ben Laurie from the Newsletter, who are getting abused, and it's got to stop. And then there are the politicians, like what Arlene Foster goes through, Carla Lockhart from the DUP. It's unbelievable, and it needs to stop.
You mentioned Arlene Foster. It's not so long ago we heard of her defamation case against Dr. Christian Jessen, which she was successful in. She was awarded £125,000. Is your settlement in the region of that?
Yes.
It is. So it's kind of low six figures, as it were. Or
yes.
Do you want to tell us what it is?
I'm happy leaving it at a six-figure sum. But yes, it's low six figures. And by the way, if it had gone to court, I would have been looking a lot more, because this guy, you know, I don't know. I just want lots of markers that what he did was unacceptable, you know.
I don't know. I'm going to be fully transparent. I don't know whether I would ask this next question if there wasn't so much debate around you and your income. But
sure,
there is, and I'm going to ask the question. Are you going to keep the money?
Yeah, I am.
Where I'm standing on the front lawn outside City Hall, 100 years ago there would have been a smell of fresh paint wafting in the air. The street furniture had been given a lick to freshen it up. Local businesses had been closed. The sale of alcohol had been restricted so that no one made a show of themselves, we can assume, because the King and the Queen were in town for the state opening of Northern Ireland's first Parliament. I'm on the lawn outside City Hall. In 1921 there were stands built here for 3,000 invited guests. There was a lot of pomp and ceremony, and of course we know, and history has told us, this was a day of two perspectives, and we know there are lots of perspectives on today. But joining me here on the front lawn is a man who, I think by his own admission, spent the lockdown doing a deep dive into the events in Northern Ireland of 1921. His name is David Torrens. He works in the House of Commons Library. He's a specialist in Northern Ireland, and he's here as the anniversary of the opening of the State Parliament is happening. Broadly speaking, David, welcome to Evening Extra. Broadly speaking, what stands out for you on the events of this day 100 years ago?
I think the fact that the King was here with the Queen, against the advice of many at the palace who were concerned about security, concerned about assassination attempts.
But their loved ones were exonerated by a coroner. Is that something that an information recovery body will be able to do with the same weight and authority?
Well, one of the things I said today in the command paper outlines is we've got to make sure that that information recovery process, I'm determined, does have the sort of powers that it needs to work in a really clear, focused way. Operation Canova is a very good example of this. Where
I'm sorry to interrupt you. This is about the weight and the power of a coroner to exonerate people.
I absolutely understand that point. That's why we want to work with people around the proposals we're setting out. They are to inform and be part of the discussion and the engagement in the weeks ahead around what that information recovery exactly looks like, to make sure that, again,
would
a coroner's report is not a criminal justice process, and it's taking far too long for people to get to the truth. We want a system that gets to the truth, gets that accountability and understanding.
Would it be judge-led?
Well, there's no final decisions made on exactly
how this
body
would be led.
Would
you like to see
it
judge-led?
I want to see something that works to get information in a way that people can have confidence in, and that's what the discussions in the weeks ahead will be about.
Your plan wants to stop civil cases too. Was there something wrong with how the Omer families brought a successful civil action against the people who killed their loved ones?
No, and I think everybody has to deal with the situation as they find it at the time they're at, and as you look at what the situation is, but legally as you move forward. Our position at the moment is that we want to move away potentially from a system that is preventing the ability for so many people to get to the truth with information recovery, for society more widely, as well as those who are victims, to have the ability for reconciliation. And I do mean more widely, with things as we talked about today in the House of Commons around, for example, integrated education areas from the Belfast Agreement that have not not yet been delivered upon. And actually, looking at the reality that criminal justice at the moment seems to be getting in the way of that. And actually, how do we move this forward in a way, but not then just create a replication of the problems we've seen before?
But,
that's why we want to engage on these proposals.
And you're banning similar family groups to those of the Omar families doing similar. Nicola, can I ask, what is it like giving your own child CPR from a mum's perspective?
Well, I wasn't really in mum. I think I just went into nurse mode and I didn't really think about it for a few months after what I'd done. So it was a few months after I had a bit of a meltdown, realising what I'd done. And I don't really like to think about it. I obviously realise this cause is very important, so I'm happy to talk about it. But I couldn't believe what I was doing, just couldn't believe it. But I suppose I had the professional hat on too, so I knew what to do and I knew I could help. And
was there a sense of almost going into autopilot on it?
Yes, completely.
Up to 60,000 people are expected to line the streets of Belfast tomorrow for the Northern Ireland Centennial Parade. It's a year late for reasons we all understand, but one small band from an Orange Hall in County Antrim have been given the daunting task of leading the entire procession. I went along to a final rehearsal last night. The sky is taking on its evening glow above Burnside Orange Hall, just outside Antrim town. Down on the ground, marching its way around an astroturf pitch, is a group of musicians, all anxious to get it absolutely right.
Hands up!
This is the Kelswater Flute Band. They're celebrating their 75th anniversary this year, and like most bands of their type, this is a family affair. Members are quite literally following in the footsteps of their fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers.
Hi, my name's Alistair MacDonald, and I'm the secretary of Kelswater Flute Band. We're quite chuffed about being involved in the parade come Saturday, so we are.
When did you get the call, and who called you to tell you that you guys have been selected to head the whole thing off?
Well, it was the Grand Lodge of Ireland had got in touch with us and asked us would we be interested, and of course we were very interested. Look, there's going to be lots of good bands there come Saturday.
Ara, stop being modest, you're the one leading it off. What makes a good band?
There's lots of different things. It's a teamwork, detail as well, musical detail, being good on the drill side as well, and just having good crack, basically.
It's a chemistry almost.
It is.
Alistair's family DNA is baked into this band.
My father was one of the founder members of the band, so I didn't have a choice about whether to go to the band or not. I was taken to the band, and I must say I thoroughly enjoyed it. My son and daughter are both in it, and my two grandchildren are both in it now as well. Cousins and all that through the years have been in the band.
And you play the flute. Did you have a choice in whether you play the flute or not?
Well, I started off, all good flute players start off in the triangle.
The percussionist playing the triangle tomorrow with Kelswater will be Sam. He's 9 and he's Alistair's grandson. Give it a whack there for me till we hear it.
You just hit it at the same time as the bass drum.
And do you have to hit it in a certain part of it, or do you hit it anywhere at all?
You have to hit it in the bottom of it.
What if you hit it in one of the top bits, the side bits?
I think it makes a different sound.
Well, go on then, here, let's go mad. Oh, it does. There is a different tone to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
So you've been doing that for 2 years?
Yeah.
And are you going to upgrade then in an instrument?
Yeah, I'm going to play the flute when I'm older.
Have you started learning it?
Yeah.
And do you like the band music and the flute?
Yeah, because it's just sounds nice.
More of your stories later, including, we hope, from a man who was who found himself on a ferry in the Irish Sea this afternoon. You can imagine how he was feeling when he got to Terra Firma in Holyhead.
I spoke to him earlier and the voice was kind of sitting quite low in his stomach. And
swallowing a lot.
He was, so just arriving in Holyhead now. It's like, I bet, yeah. Said things were kind of falling around the boat and stuff, which, although sick-making, is also quite frightening, I'm sure, as well.
Terrifying.
Apparently they were at Dunleary, I think it was, and they were going nowhere. They were delayed for about an hour and a half. And then there was a kind of a dip in the weather conditions, and the harbour master said, if you're going to go, go now.
I was born 80 years ago in Upper Over, Regnacon, Roscommon.
It's just her voice. What was she like?
Slightly mischievous, cuddly and all those kind of things. Yeah, Granny Wynne was a humdinger. She did 25 years this year.
Now, Granny, do you remember the black and tan years?
Yeah, I do. I remember the black and tan years. I remember our house being raided on several occasions. And I remember them pulling down the Sacred Heart picture and in case there was anything behind it. And lucky enough, there was nothing to condemn us. And I remember them taking the socks of my brother, making him take off his socks and hand them over. And anything they said, you did it, or else you died.
This was recorded sitting at our fireplace in the sitting room. And I don't know why we did this. I don't know why we did this, whose idea it was. Probably my mum's idea.
But yeah, I think that's because the, you know, the kind of naturally cynical part of me is rolling my eyes. But actually, when you listen to it, it's so lovely. And what a brilliant thing to do. And I'm sure lots of other people listening will really, really wish they'd done the same with their grandparents.
I had a new cassette recorder. That's what it was, with a little microphone. And I wanted to use it.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, take this off for a second.
Okay.
Because
we do have the issue of the weather, Jeff.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's now almost 11 o'clock. There's not exactly a need for a torch, is there?
No. This is what we call 8 octaves of cloud. We count cloud amounts in octaves. This is about as bad as it gets, I'm afraid.
But you made the box.
I know. I'm quite disappointed about that.
Can you already tell that it's a bit dimmer than it would be this time of day as you look around?
No, not really.
Well, I mean, what is happening up there? Just remind people.
So the light from the sun has come these thousands of millions of miles across the galaxy, through the ether of space. And at this moment, at this time, the moon on its orbit around the Earth is just starting to encroach, so casting a shadow between the sun and us, just where we happen to be, nibbling out about 40% of the sun's coverage from us.
Look what's happening.
Yeah, there is a little gap emerging, Declan. There is a little gap.
But that gap is getting bigger.
Yes.
And we might... Should I put my lid on?
I think you should put that...
Put my lid on. Hold my mic.
Somebody's smiling at us.
Get in the box. That's it. Look around. So we need to orientate you towards the sun. That's it. That's you. That's about you there. We have got a little bit of a gap. I honestly can't see a direct view of the sun at the moment, but there is a bigger gap coming. I can see a...
Jeff, I can't see anything.
But you're not getting a lot of direct light at the moment.
Oh, right.
Oh, I can just see an outline of the sun. I'm just orientating your box towards it. No, and the clouds just come over again. It's not going to happen for us, Declan.
So right now I'm just a guy on a roof wearing a box.
Yeah, afraid so.
Oh, that felt really cool. That felt for a second like it was going to happen. Oh, Jeff.
Look, there it is. The clouds are...
Oh, okay, go again.
Look, the cloud is... You can actually see it with the cloud. Don't look directly.
Oh, I see it!
You can see it's taken a little...
Oh, my God, it's unbelievable! That is unbelievable.
So because only a tiny bit of light can go into the aperture, what I'm looking at is all dark, apart from the bright little spot of the sun, and there's like a bite out of it. Not as much as 40-odd%, just only like 20% of it. That is amazing. For all the world, what I'm looking at in here looks like a Halloween moon, you know, in a dark sky. Wow.
Wow.
You didn't get to see it.
I did.
Oh, you saw it too?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was as clear for you as it was for me?
Yeah, it was wonderful. Amazing.